talk this evening, we'll be discussing computer simulations of evolution. That is, attempts to model certain features of evolution on a computer. First time I heard anything about this, as far back as I can remember, was a colloquium held at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia some years ago in the mid-60s, as I recall, which was called Mathematical Challenges to the Neo-Darwinian Interpretation of Evolution. And basically what developed in that situation was a controversy between mathematicians and biologists over whether or not the model of mutation and natural selection would actually produce the phenomena that we see in the fossil record, very complex living organisms that have developed in the course of, from one-celled organisms in not more than perhaps a billion years, and very sudden appearances of virtually all the major animal phyla at the beginning of the Cambrian period, rather rapid development of other sorts of things. And the argument by the mathematicians was that the model as presently presented would not work on a computer to do the kind of things that it ought to do. I made some little attempt to do some literature searching on the whole area of computer simulations evolution, and was rather surprised that I could not find too much out there. Now, I did not spend days looking, and did not have any real computer material to work with. I was at the University of Maryland Library, which has fairly decent science libraries, and looking through their microfiche on subjects that seemed to me evolution, simulation, computer, and that sort of thing that would point in that particular direction. I would not guarantee I did not miss a great deal. I did not go back that far, but I did not find a lot in looking at just the recent year or two on that particular matter. I've been interested in the subject for some time. I ran across a reference several years ago to attempts to design a machine that would make copies of itself, we call a self-reproducing automaton. And some years ago, I designed a little computer program that would imitate a automaton designed by a fellow named Christopher Langton, and published an article on that in the what was previously the Journal of American Scientific Affiliation. And at the end of it, I challenged anyone to see if they could produce a simpler automaton that would reproduce itself. And lo and behold, a year later, a fellow came up with a somewhat simpler one. The programs for those two automatons would be a computer representation of what would presumably be something like a large array of little computer chips that you would turn on a certain group of them in such a way that they would then proceed in the following time steps to turn on other computer chips around them to make an exactly similar array to the one that they were. And then that new array would make another daughter of it, and that sort of thing going on. And Langton's program, that is, which I wrote up from his description, is this program Repro, which is on our diskette that we have here. And then John Biles' program, a simpler program of a little sort of thing that will make a copy of itself, that will reproduce, if you like, is this program called Bile here, B-Y-L. I suggested in working out Langton's one that it was really extremely unrealistic to think of something like that or something resembling that, of that complexity forming in the length of time we have available in the size universe we've got available. Self-reproducing automaton designed by Bile is much simpler, but in going back and trying to be more realistic with several of the calculations I made, it still seemed to me unlikely that something of that sort would form in the length of time we have in our universe. So our discussion here is not really going to be a literature search, and I'm not going to say anything more about these two programs that attempt to investigate the question, what is the simplest mechanism that would reproduce itself? What would be the simplest machine you could make that would reproduce itself? Already back with William Paley in his book Natural Theology, he pointed out that the question of the design of life, etc., is really not so much to be compared to a watch and finding a watch and seeing that it had a designer, but rather to be compared to the idea of finding a watch that could make watches, that could actually reproduce itself, something more complicated. So the idea of self-reproduction really goes back that far. There certainly has been a fair amount of computer simulations and such in trying to deal with the question of competition among different varieties of things, or the question of the spread of a variety among population and that sort of thing. And that's not really what I'm interested in our discussion tonight either. So those are all areas of what we don't want to talk about. What do we want to talk about? We want to talk about three computer programs. Two of these were designed by the fellow I mentioned here on the in our notes, Richard Dawkins, a biologist who has written a rather popular work called The Blind Watchmaker, in which he claims that Paley was wrong. There's not a watchmaker behind the universe. There's not a mind behind the universe. But in fact, the mechanism that produces apparent order in our universe is actually blind. That is, not intelligent, really, what he meant was his claim. And he presents two programs in his thing, which we want to discuss a little bit. He did not actually produce publish the details on exactly what the steps in the program were or anything of that sort. He just told you what it did, and so he had to design a program that did that same thing. I call one of these programs Biomorph, and it's intended to emulate the phenomenon that we see in living things, namely that there is a part of the thing that represents the information on how it forms, what we call the DNA, that gives information for how the living thing builds itself, so to speak. And then there's the actual form that it builds. And he points out that mutation takes place on the DNA, but selection takes place on the form. We want to look at that program a little bit and come back and discuss that. Another program which he dealt with was the whole problem of producing order out of randomness. He was aware of such statements as give enough monkeys enough time and they'll eventually type the Encyclopedia Britannica or the works of Shakespeare or that sort of thing. And so what he does is he designs a program in which a random typist constrained by some mutation techniques will eventually rather rapidly type a line out of Shakespeare's Hamlet. Methinks it is like a weasel, the actual phrase. So this program Shakes is an attempt to do something of that sort, but generalizing it so that you can put your own phrase in and get the computer to, by random mutation and selection, to approach that particular result. The third program is one I designed myself and had been thinking about for some time, and that is a program in which we take the English language to be a model for a living thing. English language has a hierarchy within it. You've got at the lowest level letters, and those letters combine to form English words, and those English words combine to form sentences, and the sentences combine. Notice you've got a hierarchy of some sort, which is a little bit like the situation you've got in living things, where certain molecules form the molecules that operate in a cell, and then they have a hierarchy that structures them in some way, and the cells themselves are structured by hierarchy and such, and you go up the line on that sort of thing. We're going to discuss then these three programs in the time we've got available. These programs basically deal with an emphasis on the mechanism, on the question of mutation and natural selection, and to what extent that is effective in doing what we, in producing what we see here in the variety of living things on a planet that certainly is not 5 billion years old and certainly has not yet much over 3 billion years of time for evolution by the standard time scales that the scientists are working with these days. As I mentioned again for a minor advertisement, these 5 programs, both in their run form and in the form that shows you what the actual code is, what the actual basic computer statements are available on this diskette. So if you're interested in that, after you have copies of that up here. The first program we want to look at is a program I call Biomorph, from the idea of the form of a living thing. The program I've done is perhaps very slightly simplified from the program Dawkins describes. He has various pictures of these strange shapes that his computer program produces on the basis of a series of 9 numbers. The numbers are intended to define something about these little trees. And some of them look very much like trees, but others of them begin to look like bugs or begin to look like UFOs or aliens or cathedrals or various other things of that sort. Basically, he's got three different kinds of numbers in his genetic code, if you like. A number that tells you how many levels of branching you will have in this tree. It's going to produce a tree of some sort when you start out with an original branch. And then if you have a recursion depth of 1, that means that branches. If you have a recursion depth of 2, each of those branches will branch. And if you have a recursion depth of 3, each of the branches will also branch. Okay? In this particular program, but both his version and my version, each of them only split in 2. They don't split into 3 or 4 or 5 or that sort. So that would be one of the things. You would tell it how many levels of branching take place. The next thing you would do is you would tell it something about the branching angle, and you could, of course, make a very simple program where the angle of branching, that is the directional change at each branch point, whether that would be the same at every level or whether that will change at each level. And then the branch length, you could also specify that as one fixed branch length, and you get rather uninteresting looking branches here like this, vaguely like parts of a honeycomb, perhaps. Or if, in fact, you change the lengths and change the angles, then you can get some rather strange-looking sorts of things. Basically, what Dawkins says is this is a sample of a very simple way. You have a very simple DNA, so to speak, and that's a list of 9 numbers. And he doesn't tell you what the numbers do other than this rather general sort of thing. And then if you specify those numbers, that will produce a certain shaped tree. And then what he does is he mutates that tree by taking each of the numbers and moving it down one digit or up one digit, and then showing what that tree looks like, and take the next of the digits and move that down and up one, etc. Well, I basically did the same thing as he did. He may have had some curvature in some of his branches. Looking at the pictures, I would have judged that to be so. And I felt that was too much trouble to make that work on a computer. So I ignored any curvature in the thing, but basically went with 8 digits, those digits basically represent the first one, how many layers of branching do you have, and then a couple of different angles and some kind of a third number to tell you whether to use one of the angles all the time, the other angle all the time, to switch back and forth every different level of branching or such, and then 3 links for branch lengths, and a little number to tell you what to do with that, all of this kind, or do the first one, the second one, the third one, or things like that. And so the computer program, when it comes on, it asks you to give these 8 numbers. And the instructions on the program tell you what those numbers are. And then, once you've given it the set of 8 numbers, it prints out a little tree right in the middle of your screen. And then it asks you if you want to print the mutations of it, the mutants of it, if you like, just the ones that you change each of these numbers by 1. You add 1 to the number or subtract 1 to the number, and then it prints out the 16 of those. There are 8 single digits to represent the DNA. So you, in the first case, you run the first one up 1, in the second case, you run it down 1, in the third one, you run the second digit up 1, and the fourth one, you run it down 1, and you get 16 of those things out of the thing. I couldn't work out any program to print this out on my computer that got the whole screen. So this is the middle half of the screen with 8 of the mutants surrounding the original layer. And you can see already the original, this one doesn't look much like a tree. Weepy willow, maybe, but not much else like that. Whereas this looks like a fairly decent elm, perhaps. But you get other sorts of things. These are all rather tree-ish looking on this particular sample here. But you don't really have to go too far to get stuff that doesn't look terribly tree-ish. This is really just another couple steps on from that kind of thing. And you can still see that one of them looks rather tree-ish, but the others look rather buggish, if you like. Certainly this has a buggy look to it. This looks perhaps a little bit more like a half-built house or something. And a number of them really did have some sort of a cathedral-ish look to them as well. The way the program worked then was, after you got these 16 laid out there, you are the selector. You are natural selection, if you like. The computer generates these 16 mutants, and you decide which one will be the ancestor for the next generation, and you type that number in, and then it prints that one in the middle of the screen, and then proceeds to crank out the 16 mutants up and down from that. And you can go on as long as that is of interest to you, and get a chance to see the sort of thing that's happening. What Dawkins attempts to show by this is not whether or not evolution works, which he certainly does, but the mutations that take place do not operate out on the body parts of the animal or plant. They operate in on the DNA, in on the genetic information. And the results that that has are out on the outside, and the selection has to do with what the form of the thing is that you get, not with what the DNA is inside. And so you're only indirectly making effects on the DNA or selecting out what the DNA is doing. So lessons we can draw from Biomorph, and I have no problem with what Dawkins says in this particular area, is that mutation operates on the genetic information, but selection doesn't operate on the DNA. It operates on the developed form. But of course, in selecting out this developed form instead of that one, you automatically select whatever the DNA was that generated that. And what you see rather easily with these simple ones, and there would be this would be true certainly to a certain extent as well with living things as well, the same form may conceal different DNA. There would be certain things in the DNA that would not show up on the surface. You're aware perhaps from Mendel's experiments back in the middle of the last century, actually right back about Darwin's time, though they didn't become publicly known, or at least not widely known until early in the century, that you could have certain pea plants that looked a certain way, but then when you saw their descendants without any further mutation, the descendants, some of them would look like the parent, and some of them looked very different. That is, they would conceal certain things, which would then be show up on further descent. So you get a little bit of that from this computer program Biomorph, and I certainly don't think I would have any problem with those. I think we've got warrant to believe that evolution on the micro level, on the level of making small changes to allow plants and animals to handle different environments and such, seems to be something that really takes place, and there's no particular reason to believe that at least a good bit of it does not occur by mutation and the selection of those in the environment, which things operate better. Of course, it's not always easy to tell whether you've actually got a mutation or whether you've got something that is in the DNA as a recessive trait and comes out occasionally. There's been some argument over the moths in England, the light-colored and dark-colored moths, whether that's a mutation or whether that's just a variety within the population. Dawkins' second program, the one I call Program Shakes, is attempting to deal with this remark that we mentioned earlier. Give a few monkeys enough time, and they'll eventually type out the works of Shakespeare. Dawkins does not deny that if you set monkeys to typing, you are not going to get very great progress anytime soon. And he says, no, you certainly won't do that. But he says evolution works better than that. Evolution has some technique of selecting out better results. And so he tries to illustrate a way of selecting out better results by doing this. He says, let a monkey type out a line of gibberish. And we will presume it's a line of gibberish the same length as methinks it is like a weasel. Okay? And then you have mutations begin on that. Random mutations begin on that. But every time a mutation takes place, you compare the mutation and its parent with the target phrase that you're headed for. You think so it's like a weasel. And what he shows is, as you might think if you actually work through it, that you're going to get there an awful lot faster with this technique than you ever will if you just have the monkeys out there doing it on their own. He gives some humongous number for how long it would take to get even a phrase like that by just having the monkeys typing off at full blast, whereas when he tries out various random starting points to go there, he finds then that in 43 or 64 or 41 generations, for the three examples he gives, the result actually converges on what he thinks is like a weasel. Now, he doesn't tell you exactly what he's doing in a couple of points. He doesn't tell you whether the mutation is totally random or whether he's doing what we were doing back there in the Biomorph, that is taking each letter and mutating it up one and down one. And he doesn't tell you how many samples you're comparing in each generation. I just presumed he was doing one random variation and then comparing that with the mother and picking the one that was closer at each generation. But when I designed a computer program to do that, I found that it did not close nearly as fast as he did. In fact, I could not get it to be thinks it is like a weasel in a thousand generations. Not sure I could spot in my notebook how close it got. It got off in that general direction, certainly, by a thousand generations. Let's see if we can find it here. This is it here. As you're aware, it is somewhat difficult to pronounce gibberish. But in 700 generations, it had gotten to the Fidgebix. It is like our alpha still. So it had a ways to go at that point. It was about 40 units away from its target. And although that had come down quite drastically from being about 300 units away from its target, I also found running programs like this that they made much, much slower progress the closer they got to the solution. Because the fewer mutations are good that head you in the right direction. When you're only one letter away, you've got to have the right mutation on the right letter. That is, have this whole thing, have a 28-character sequence. You've now got to have the mutation on the right one of the 28 characters, and it's got to be exactly one unit in the right direction, because you're within one unit of this set. So I really didn't make it. I tried a shorter phrase, not with as much classical background as that one. Happy birthday. And that didn't make it in a thousand generations. With a program in which you do a random mutation on one of the characters, and it can be either some other letter of the alphabet or blank, that's really all I had choosing from, and then chose either the mutation or its mother as the one to try the next mutation. In other words, I didn't write 50 of them and then chose the best of the 50, which is really kind of compacting 50 generations. But they're this way. I finally managed to go down to a shorter phrase, a more classical sort of corvallis, got there at 867 generations. To get up anywhere near the rate of closure that Dawkins had, I found I had to go through and make a change in each letter, a random change in each letter of the thing, and then pick out whether that or the mother was better, and count a generation when I'd run through the whole set, so I might have had as many as 15 changes in the set. Then we would finally close in, and I got several of them to do it in less than 100. But they were really quite close up to 100. So exactly what Dawkins been doing to get this stuff to close in 43, 64, and 41 generations, I do not know. But I don't think he was as straightforward with us as he often been when the results were obtained at that particular point. There are some lessons we can learn from this program Shapes. One of them is, and this I think is probably the major reason why evolutionists without strong worldview things to grind, axes to grind, perhaps feel that evolution must be true, and that is what we call a ratchet mechanism works. In this program, you only make one change at a time, and you always pick the one that is closer to the target, that is better, than whichever it is, whether it's the original or whether it's the one you mutated. You always pick the one that's closest, and so you never lose any progress you make. You only make one change. You always pick the better one, whether it's the one you changed or whether it's the one you changed to. And so you never lose any progress. Well, that's a ratchet mechanism. You know, like when I want to jack the old kind, which you want like this. You push it up, and it goes up. But when you pull it back, it ratchets so it doesn't go up. So you've got one of those screwdrivers that you're turning the tail, the ratchet handle on the same sort of thing. Well, ratchet mechanisms work. And clearly then, if that's all there is, evolution work. The problem is, as we'll see when we look at our third program here, the particular program we're looking at is very strongly guided evolution. That is, it's got a target it's aiming at. Now, obviously, evolution is presented by persons who believe there's a God out there. It can't very well be guided in a strong sense. It's headed nowhere, etc. That's certainly the Gould who represents the situation. There's no mind out there. It's purely accidental, etc. Well, if there's no mind out there, then you aren't comparing it with some target. You're just comparing whether it works or not. And obviously, we've got some very low-level life in some sense, that is, single-cell life, that still works very well now.
not obvious that the advances on that are going to work well enough to carry over. There's a decent question there on whether you've got the time to do that sort of thing. And that, I think, is probably one of the big concerns. When you get up to the level of those organisms that have the more complicated cells, the eukaryotic cells rather than the prokaryotic cells, that kind of got a real nucleus inside, etc., they're very accurate in making copies of their DNA. They only make about one error out of every 100 million copies. And so you don't have mutation going on very fast in individuals. You've got to have big populations to get many mutations, and then you've got to find some way to get those mutations together to actually get progress in the data. We're going to look at that a little bit here on our third program example. When you are headed for a target, and presumably when you're headed for some kind of an optimum solution to a particular mechanical problem that a blood cell or a amoeba or something might be solving in some way, you find out that the last piece to make the puzzle work is very highly constrained. You can't just have anything. That's what showed up here in these programs where we were aiming for. Look at the Corvallis one here, the happy birthday one here. The pages to find it. Yeah, here's the happy birth, starting out with O-W-M-E blank, J-E-H-T blank, K-E-Y-K. That's what we started out with. That is 242 units away from the solution. And by the time you've only run about, by the time you've run 20 mutations on that, you've covered half the distance, down to about only 120 units away. And by the time you've run it 350 times, you're still about 40 units away. And by the time you've run 900 units, you're still 30 units away. 900 mutations, you're still 30 units away. And when I gave up at 1,000, I was still 33 units away. So, in fact, there was no accepted mutation from 884 to 1000. Couldn't find anything better because it had happy birthday. It's an A instead of a blank in the one spot, and the whole rest of it done. But the distance from an A to a blank in ASCII is 32 or whatever, so 33, so it never did. It would eventually hit on a blank, and that's about the same kind of constraint for this. So, and yet we see again and again in living things, many, many features in living things that are optimal. You know, they look like they are the solution to some maximum or minimum problem. And you wonder how you easily could get in that sort of thing, in any kind of reasonable time. I move on to the third program here, the program I call MUNSL. That is an acronym for Mutation and Natural Selection. The idea here is to simulate mutation and natural selection by analogy with human language. Basically, you say here, we're going to have a string of letters, spaces are allowed as well, and they represent the gene, if you like, but also the organism itself. This is kind of a representation of the thing, and a string that is made up, perhaps, of all one-letter words, or is just a one-letter word itself, I or A, O, is a one-celled organism, if you like. And a string that is made up of three letters or four three-letter words or something like that you might think of as a colony organism of some sort. Whereas a string that is made up of not only a set of good English words, I've chosen English, chauvinistic word here, but English words, and the English words would be in English syntax order, and they would make some sense. That would be equivalent to a rather complicated animal of some sort, a multi-cell animal with backbone and fur and fangs and all of that sort of thing. So, the program basically has us either start out with something that already makes sense, like this is a sentence, or start out with something that's, say, just a single letter, or start out with gibberish. Start out any way you want to. Mutation is done by the program.
the program, once it gets started, you feed it this piece of information, you tell it to start, and it then goes in and it randomly picks one of the letters there from this end. There might be a space or something at this end, but this end, all the way across, it picks one of those and says, I'm going to do something with that, and then it randomly decides what it's going to do. It's going to put a space there, it's going to put one of the letters of the alphabet there, and it does it. And then, so for instance, it selects a position at random. For instance, it may select the end, the first ended sentence, and then it chooses a letter of space at random. Let's say it chooses C, and then it gives you back the result. This is a sentence. And you represent natural selection. Okay? And you look at it and you say, is this English? And if you think it is, you allow it to survive. And if you think it is not, you kill it. So you operate as natural selection. So that's a program. Very simple program. And by the way, a couple of these programs are really designed so you can mess with them. In other words, it's not not just going to sit there and run for you. By the way, none of them are near as interesting programs as what you can pay a quarter to play up at one of the arcades or anything of that sort. Without color, no graphics. Well, got a little graphics, but not exactly fast moving, anything of that sort. But all of them give you a chance to experiment around yourself. This one, you can do different things like, am I going to start with gibberish or start with meaning? Am I going to start with a single letter or am I going to start with something longer? Am I going to say natural selection requires it to come out as English words, or is natural selection allowed to come out as Spanish words? There are no tildes, but you can still do that otherwise, or Hebrew for that matter, as long as you make up some transliteration scheme that only uses all 26 letters. You can have it come out any way you want there. Or you can just say, well, will I try to see if I can get it to make sense? Start out with a single letter and see if I can build up the multiple letter words and see if I can get the words to be defined and make sense and all of that sort of thing. And you get some feel for how complex it is to step from one level to another in this sort of a thing. For instance, I started out with some single letter alternatives first, like X. And after 331 mutations and natural selections, I did manage to get three words in English, and the two longest ones were four-letter words, and the other one was a two-letter word, subs, us, and asks, but the syntax obviously was not doing much. I weren't really conveying anything, and I could not, in the length of time I had any patience to work with it, get to any place where I was getting any sense out of anything. And of course, even if I were getting sense out of it, in a sense, it's natural selection that is making the sense out of it. I did another one starting from X and wound up with do key in as after 274 trials. And another one starting with the letter A and getting vamp space at and such. So what you're really seeing, I think, is that even with hundreds of mutations and natural selections, you still have not gotten out of the very simple level stuff. You're not getting into any higher level complexity. I tried Dawkins or Shakespeare's methinks it is like a weasel, and ran that for 59 generations with selection. That is, I required that I only allow anything to replace it if that thing, at least all of them spell words, they're still words, and it was not able to find anything in 59 tries, anything that was different than that. Did not replace the T here by an S or the I by an A or something of that sort. It didn't happen to do that in 59 generations. On the other hand, if we started with methinks it's like a weasel, and didn't use any selection on it. In 46 generations, you had something that looked nothing like the starting point. And in fact, it only took about 10 generations to get something in which none of the words were words anymore. That is, you had lost the information in all of the individual words, as well as losing immediately the syntax, etc. This is a sentence I ran for about 67 tries with selection, and wound up with this stunning sentence, this I sentence Ahab, as the result. That is, you lost the syntax. And my guess would be that if you required that you retain the meaning, you would have had the same word after that, and maybe even after 1,000 runs at it, because there may be no other English sentences that are within one letter of this. And therefore, this sentence is isolated from all other English meanings by a great ocean of gibberish, if you like, or semi-gibberish.
The question is, does that same thing occur in organized living things? Are the functional forms separated from other functional forms by great oceans of unfunctional forms? And if that's the case, can you really get from nothing to what we've got by the procedures that we're actually working with? Some of the lessons I was able to draw from oneself is, one, I do believe that we have warrant for suggesting that the analogy is not unreasonable. But complex organisms are hierarchies of structure, and in that sense, they resemble languages. Now, you have to think a little bit about whether they sufficiently resemble languages that you don't lose something in making an analogy of that sort. Mutation rather clearly works at the lowest level only. It's working on the individual units of some sort. That would be modified perhaps slightly by the fact that these units of DNA are then making things out there in the bottom, which might turn out that one unit here is actually making some dispersed things in the bottom, or several units in here are coming together to make one thing out in the body. There's evidence of that. Non-selected mutations produce gibberish, and this is a very severe problem for a theory that has at least been broached on several occasions, that the way to get from scales to feathers, the way to get from functional running front limbs to flying front limbs, is by turning off a gene that will control some of those things, having a lot of random mutations on it until it's ready to produce feathers now instead of scales, and turn it back on. You turn off an extra copy of the stuff that makes scales, you mutate it for a while until it's ready to make feathers, and then you turn it back on. And the trouble is that non-selected mutations produce gibberish. Now, you can obviously argue, do they always produce gibberish? Well, no, probably not. You can actually probably do some calculations. I did a little thing here somewhere along the line. I was attempting to figure out, for a language like English, the number of possible one-letter words, two-letter words, three-letter words, four-letter words, five-letter words, etc. And if you're not too careful, if you don't worry too much about you having to follow Q all the time, certain consonant combinations never occurred in English, there are 26 possible one-letter words, A, B, C, etc. There are 676 possible two-letter words, 17,576 possible three-letter words, etc. It goes on up. There are slightly over 300 million six-letter words, etc. And then you ask yourself, how many of those are actually used in our language? Well, there are three one-letter words used in our language out of the 26, A, I, and O. There, I had counted 49 two-letter words, but looking over my list this evening, I had I, M for one of those, and I'm not at all sure that that is a two-letter word in English, so maybe it's only 48 things. Now, what you find is a little over one-tenth of the one-letter combinations are actually used as words in English, but only about seven-hundredths of the two-letter words are used. I was not about to try and figure out all the three-letter words in English, or the four-letter words, or five-letter words, but I found a crossword dictionary that gave big lists of six-letter, seven-letter, eight-letter, nine-letter, ten-letter words. And at least what I found there, they're not exhaustive, but what I found there was that with six-letter words, they only gave about 2 out of 100,000 of the possibilities were actually functioning in English. And by the time you got down to 10-letter words, only about 1 out of 10 billion of the combinations were actually functional. I think you probably got something like that in the DNA situation. That is that you don't have a very high density of functional combinations. And so the question then is, are you at all likely with non-selected patients to get anything but gibberish? And my guess is no, you're not. Now, if you've got mutations that don't confer any advantage on the plant or animal, and you're going to try and see if maybe they can come to dominate the population because the next mutation on them will convey an advantage, but the mutation on the thing that's competing with won't, you run into the problem that neutral mutations do not tend to take over population. They spread by what we call a random rug. That is, they may accidentally get slightly larger or accidentally get slightly smaller. They're not going to take it over very quickly. But lastly, and what I already have wandered into a little bit on, is that functional isolation seems to be a very, very serious problem. How do you get across boundaries where you have to have a whole sequence of coordinated changes to make something that actually functions? And the chances of getting three or four, even, mutations that work together when none of them particularly help anything by themselves, or maybe make things detrimental by themselves, just seems to me to get you into some very, very serious problems. Well, that basically is the tour so far of these computer programs. They don't say anything particularly profound. They do provide an opportunity for those of a sufficiently hacking nature to want to try out some of these programs to actually go in and see how some of these things work. The two self-reproducing automata programs, the one described here, that was the more complicated one, and the one described in the ASA journal later by Bile, both show you that you can devise a little mechanism that will make copies of itself. Probably shouldn't have been too surprised about that, I suppose. They do give you some feel for the complexity of these things. I do a calculation in here on the complexity of Langton's automaton, the one that looks like a little, as you can see it from back there, it looks like a little sort of a cube or something of that sort. Its tail comes out, comes around and makes another loop, and then brings this off and tail up here, and tail up here, and a new one. If you start making new copies, you start getting granddaughters and such. You can actually do calculations on that, how unlikely it is. You can also do something else, which I did a little of, and I think would be fun to do, and that is do a mutation on one of these and see whether it survives. I took this particular case and tried out all of the simple mutations I could think of, and only one of them survived. That is, it didn't blow the whole thing apart in a few stages that it died. And that particular one really just made another tail sticking out one of the other corners. Double-tailed animal, instead of a single-tailed animal, if you like. And I made that one by trying to figure out how you made a tail on the other one and then making a mutation that would do that sort of thing. So it was very strongly guided, though, sort of a random mutation would eventually produce that. It would be easy also to take Wiles' program and do some mutations. I have not tried that either. I think there is a real need for working with things like this because you here are at least trying to objectively examine whether the mechanisms we have not proposed for evolution will do what they're cracked up to do. And the person can always say, well, the real mechanism will work and we haven't found it yet. But of course, Darwin claimed he had found it. That was really the big foundation of his program. He didn't understand mutations, he understood variety. And a new Darwinian proponent certainly claimed we have found it. Now, the punctuate equilibria guys probably would claim we have not found it. There's still something else going on over there. But the claim is that there is some purely random procedure that can only produce organization. And we can see it's a fairly substantial organization, if you like, in making snowflakes or making crystals or something of that sort, that the shape of a molecule or its forces constrain certain shapes form more easily as you add on molecules and a solution, etc. But we're not talking about that kind of organization. We're talking about organization that looks like gibberish unless you know the key. But when you know the key, you find a very complicated, organized system of some sort. A foreign language looks like gibberish until you know what it means, and then you find out the person who's saying something, and there's something quite complicated. Well, we can see from the outworking of the genomes in animals and plants and such, that in fact the product they produce is very complex, and it consists of a lot of interacting parts, even down to the molecular level. And so the information you've got there is not gibberish, it's something very, very controlled. The question is, can you get from gibberish to that by a series of random processes of which the only thing you've got is survival to select out the better from the worse? Okay, you better quit at that point, and I will try and field a few questions.